This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, our periodic update on U.S. politics, outrage and lawsuits after U.S. President Donald Trump declares a national emergency after not receiving congressional funding for his border wall. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. After the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, Congress agreed on a stopgap measure with President Trump in late January to reopen the government, but it did not include funding for his proposed wall along the southern border with Mexico. So 3 weeks later, a bipartisan congressional committee crafted a longer-term spending bill that included some funding for border security, but fell far short of the $5.7 billion figure Mr. Trump wanted for a wall. To avert another shutdown, for which he would surely be blamed, President Trump signed the bill but stated that he would declare a national emergency in a bid to bypass Congress and divert funds from other government agencies for the wall. Mr. Trump is looking into tapping money from drug interdiction efforts and military construction projects. However, this action is facing significant legal challenges and widespread public opposition. A coalition of 16 states filed a federal lawsuit last week, arguing that the president's declaration of a national emergency is unconstitutional. It also says that the federal government's own data prove there is not a national emergency at the southern border. The lawsuit seeks a preliminary injunction that would prevent the president from acting on his declaration while the case plays out in the courts. In addition to this chaos, the 2020 presidential campaign is beginning to heat up, although the first primary contests are almost a year away. On the Democratic side, approximately 10 high-profile candidates have jumped into the race, including 6 current U.S. senators. Other contenders, forming possibly the largest Democratic field in history, may soon join them. Even incumbent President Trump may face a primary challenge. Well, joining us to discuss these and other issues dominating the U.S. political landscape are two veteran political analysts. John Fortier is director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And Will Marshall, he's president of the Progressive Policy Institute. It's a centrist Democratic policy group based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, let me begin with you, John, our veteran, and welcome to Will for the first time, hopefully not the last on the show.
Thank you.
Let's discuss Trump's declaration of a national emergency on the southern border. Critics say this is a manufactured crisis by Mr. Trump because he failed to get Mexico to pay for the wall, as he promised during the campaign, and then failed to get the previous Republican-controlled Congress to appropriate the money. Again, as I said in the intro, John, critics are saying that diverting the money designated for other purposes violates the separation of powers as defined by the U.S. Constitution, and argue that it's overreach by the executive branch. It seems like President Trump is testing the boundaries of his executive authority here. How do you see it?
Well, I think we should put this in the perspective of we have had very strong disagreements about what to do about building the wall. Basically, both sides were dug in and we had a government shutdown, and perhaps we were faced with another government shutdown had we not gone this route. I don't think anybody thinks it's an ideal route to go, and I think there are some questions about it, but I also think it probably is the reason that we did strike a deal going forward. The president is now going to attempt to build the wall using other methods, which will be challenged. As for the challenge, look, I think there are some legitimate questions about Congress and its role and whether the president is stepping into that. On the other hand, I do think we are arguing about a pretty small amount of money, and certainly emergency powers have been used by presidents before, not for directly these types of purposes. Some of the money he's finding is not really related to the emergency. It's repurposing funds, which, again, a president has some ability to do. And I think the courts will be involved. I guess I suspect, as the president does, that he'll probably have some opposition in some lower courts, but would not be surprised to see at least much of this go forward with the court staying out of some or affirming where he is. And then there's the question of Congress itself might want to itself declare its disapproval of this. Certainly some Republicans worried about it as a matter of separation of powers, a matter of the powers of Congress. But will they ultimately, with the House and Senate, vote to disapprove of this? And then ultimately, I don't think they'd have enough votes to override the president. So It is controversial, but it has allowed this to go forward, and I think probably the president will get at least a fair amount of what he wants at the end of the day.
Will Marshall, your take on this?
Well, I take a much more serious view of the matter. This is something new and different. This is Donald Trump crossing a political Rubicon and really exceeding his constitutional powers and usurping the clear delegation to Congress of raising and spending money. That's something presidents do not have the constitutional authority to do. It's really a straightforward matter. So this is an offense against the Constitution that the president has committed, and it's serious, and that's why there's going to be what they call a privilege resolution on the floor brought by Speaker Pelosi to disapprove of this power grab. And that means a privilege resolution which will pass the House. We'll go to the Senate, and they have to bring it up. Mitch McConnell can't sit on it, as he would probably like to do. He has to bring it to the floor, and that will present a very interesting challenge to the Republicans in the Senate. Do you uphold your vow, your oath, to uphold the Constitution of the United States, not to mention the institutional prerogatives of the United States Senate, or do you succumb to this unconstitutional transfer of power over spending, the power of the purse, to the president? Simply so he can pursue his political goals. Everyone knows there's no real emergency here. It's an abuse of the whole delegation of emergency powers to the president. Never envisioned that a president would use it for purely partisan purposes as this president has done. So I think it's a very serious new development in this chaotic Trump presidency that where now, as one humorist put it, he's standing up to the United States Constitution and threatening it. And it is up to these so-called institutionalists in the Republican Party in the Senate to stop it. This is about their constitutional powers. It's not about small amounts of money. It's about the legal authority to act. And the president doesn't really have it.
Quickly, before we move to another topic, John Fortier. So this is going to play out in the courts. There's the court of public opinion. The majority polls indicate do not approve of this measure. Why do you think he did this to assuage his political base since he wasn't able to get the money from Mexico or from Congress?
I think he did it because he's talked about wanting to do it on the campaign and felt frustrated that he wasn't able to do it with Congress's approval. Now, I do agree with Will that there are some constitutional issues. I do think that presidents in our polarized, gridlocked world have been moving in this direction. And I don't want to compare other presidents exactly, but we certainly saw other presidents express those same worries that Congress isn't acting, I'm going to act. But again, on this constitutional question, it's there. But Congress, in many laws and many ways, has delegated a lot of power to the presidency. Maybe they shouldn't have. Maybe they should come back to these things. But even the National Emergencies Act Trump is relying on is a delegation of a lot of discretion to a president.
But, Carol, I just want to make one thing really clear. The question here is not Congress didn't act. Congress acted, and it said no. It said, we're not going to give you all the money you want for this wall, which most Americans and certainly no Democrats believe in. Congress did its job. It said, no, you can have $1.7 billion. You can't have the five or six that Trump was demanding. So it's not a question of Trump having to act because Congress didn't do its job. Congress did its job. Now he's trying to do an end run around congressional power of the purse.
Let's move on now to another topic. Andrew McCabe, former acting director of the FBI, has been on the television circuit giving interviews after he wrote a book. He was acting director after President Trump fired James Comey in May 2017, and then McCabe, after he took over, launched a counterintelligence inquiry into whether Mr. Trump was in fact potentially working for Russia after Trump fired Comey, because Mr. Trump admitted that he fired Comey because of the investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election and potential ties with the Trump campaign. But also, Mr. McCabe has been saying in interviews that Trump's words and deeds illustrate that he is, in fact, more inclined to believe a U.S. foreign adversary, in this case, Russian President Vladimir Putin, over, for example, the U.S. intelligence agencies. In other words, he trusts the word of Vladimir Putin, our foreign adversary, on threats to our national security more so than our U.S. intelligence agencies. And so this was of great concern to Mr. McCabe. And the fear is that Mr. Trump may be doing Mr. Putin's bidding rather than acting out of U.S. national interest. Now, these aren't new allegations. We see them in plain sight. Mr. Trump often takes Mr. Vladimir Putin's side. But, you know, they've been renewed in light of more evidence and Mr. McCabe's accounts. What's your assessment, John Fortier, of how politically damaging this is to Mr. Trump or potentially even corrosive of our democratic institutions and law enforcement agencies?
I think you're right that Andrew McCabe's statements are consistent with things that have been going on already. And ultimately, we're hearing that perhaps we're going to get a report or some sort of finality from the Bob Mueller investigation, and then we'll know even more. I guess I think that both sides are going to take from this what they want to hear. I think Democrats are hearing, yes, there was a number of contacts with Russians, a number of ways in which the administration seems to like Russia. But Republicans are looking at an Andrew McCabe and saying, look, this is a case of the FBI really trying to undermine a new president, or others from the past administration, or others trying to use their powers in a way that is potentially not respecting the political will of the people. So I think that people are very divided on Andrew McCabe. So I don't think this is going to resolve anything. We will see the Mueller report sometime, we hope, or some aspect of a report. But again, unless it's a much more clear smoking gun where the president and his campaign have really worked with Russians to affect the election, I think that opinion is going to be divided in the way that it is today.
Well, Marshall, your take on Mr. McCabe's accounts and the opening of a counterintelligence investigation on Mr. Trump, based on so much evidence that he seems to be taking the side of a foreign adversary, and not just in this case when he fired Comey, the former FBI director, but constantly every day, and then saying that he believes Mr. Putin vis-a-vis North Korea over our U.S. intelligence agency. I wonder if it's a question of undermining the president or truly justifiable concerns over the president's allegiance.
Well, this whole question of Donald Trump's strange affection for Vladimir Putin is one of the most bizarre aspects of the Trump presidency. But here again, the fundamental question is respect for democratic norms. You've got the FBI and you've got the intelligence agencies, and this president is continually at war with them, rejecting their findings. The best experts we've got who come and tell him what's going on in the country and who document the Russian attempt to sabotage American presidential election, and he rejects it all because he's worried that he may become implicated in some way, or that people will believe that he's implicated. What he really needs is for all this to come to an end, for the Mueller report to come out and give us the final accounting, that, or as much as we're going to get. But here again, the president seems to view the FBI and the intelligence agencies as part of his personal court. The New York Times just published an incredible report on the various investigations into its dealings abroad and with Russia. But the essential fact to keep our eyes on is that the Russians are still at it. There's now evidence that they are trying to interfere in the Democratic nominating process through trolls who are making up fake news reports about racism and trying to discredit the Democratic candidates out running for president. So it's still going on, and we have a president of the United States who refuses to publicly acknowledge a malign operation by an adversary of the United States, just because he's worried that he may be called on the carpet for being too friendly with Vladimir Putin.
All right, we'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. Our guests are John Fortier, he's director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Will Marshall, from whom you just heard. He's president of the Progressive Policy Institute. We're discussing the U.S. political landscape, fallout from President Trump's declaration of a national emergency, and many other topics. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to our valued Facebook fan, Danjuma Amos from Kaduna, Nigeria. He now lives in Lagos. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, John Fortier. And as you said, we shall see if the special counsel Robert Mueller's report will be coming out in the coming days or weeks, as reports have indicated. But let's move on. And I want to pick up on something that Will Marshall was saying earlier. And that's Mr. Trump's attempts to undermine investigations against him. We now have Democrats in control of the House of Representatives, so we'll have much more oversight. We're seeing much more oversight than we did in the Republican-controlled Congress. So alleged corruption or conflicts of interest are now coming to the fore. And there's this concern that administration officials are acting out of personal financial interest rather than on behalf of the national interest. We recently heard that several current and former Trump appointees, like former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who's now actually cooperating with the special counsel, promoted the sale of nuclear power plants to Saudi Arabia, despite repeated objections from members of the National Security Council and other senior White House officials. And then these allegations that Mr. Trump is trying to derail all investigations into him and his ties with Russia or other financial ties. And of course, we're seeing him lash out more than ever against the free press, calling the New York Times the enemy of the people. How serious are these revelations, these types of statements from President Trump? And how do you see this playing out?
Look, I mean, I think no president wants any sort of investigation, and this president has been unhappy with a very serious set of investigations that have been going on. With the Democratic control of Congress, that's more opportunity for Democrats to have a place to really look into their criticisms of the Trump administration, whether it's on these questions of the Bob Mueller matters or other things in other departments. So losing one branch of Congress has this consequence, and I think we're going to see Democrats using that in a political way. I guess I do think, though, that some people think that this is all going to lead to a kind of bringing down of the Trump presidency in a kind of non-political way. It's certainly possible if we see some sort of bigger revelation that we haven't seen. But I do think it's more likely to be political, right? Is this president going to the 2020 election with more cloud around him? Is that going to hurt him? You know, frankly, I think it's probably not a good thing, but I'm not sure it's the decisive thing. You know, the other thing I would say, I guess Donald Trump has never been a very popular president, and his numbers aren't that great today, but they've come back a little bit since the problems of the government shutdown. If the election were held today with his numbers, I think he would probably lose, but he's also not someone who is as unpopular as I think that the media call him to be. So there are charges to be made. There are investigations to be done. That's one of the roles of Congress. I support that, but it's also not clear to me that it's going to lead to something other than some change at the ballot box rather than more legal or another end to the Trump presidency.
So, Will, your take on these allegations, these conflicts of interest that are starting to come out more and more, and then, of course, Mr. Trump doubling down on lashing out at the press and interfering in these investigations?
Well, I think it's important, particularly for people listening overseas, to recall this, that this is someone, Donald Trump, he has no political experience. He's never held office before. To be quite blunt about it, he really doesn't know how to be president. And so he thinks it's okay to try to demolish public confidence in an independent media. This is what autocrats do in unfree countries. They bash and harass a media that doesn't give them compliant coverage. It's another outrage. It's another undermining of democratic norms, which this president, unfortunately, just never seems to have internalized, and probably because he's never worked his way up through politics. He won his first election, astonishingly enough. That speaks to a certain kind of skill, I would say a demagogic skill, to make connection with voters. He's clearly done that. And I agree with John that I don't think proper congressional oversight, which this administration needs maybe more than any other, is necessarily going to bring him down. But it's good that they're watching. And it's good that they're demanding evidence for his actions and proof that they're justified on some basis. Because this president seems to just think that whatever whim he woke up with is enough to do things with. But in the real world of politics, you've got to make a case to people. You've got to persuade people. He's trying to create his own political reality and bond with a small minority of voters, and that's worked for him up to this point, but it didn't work for him in the midterm election when the Democrats regained control of the House. And I see no effort by this president to expand his base in a way that's going to make him competitive in the next election. So we'll probably, as John says, we'll have to wait for that, for the final public verdict on this presidency.
So back to you, John Fortier. Mr. Trump is actually facing a primary challenge. Now, it may not come to anything, but Bill Weld, this former governor of Massachusetts, has declared he will run against Mr. Trump. Again, I guess a sign that Mr. Trump isn't expanding his reach, and he's talking mostly to his rather narrow base, notwithstanding it's strong. Why do you think this is happening? Is it very common to challenge a sitting president?
There are instances, and usually it's not a great sign for a president to have a primary challenge. I will say I don't think Bill Weld's primary challenge is a very serious one. It's possible that a more serious candidate could get in, a John Kasich. I frankly don't think that even a John Kasich would really do much damage to Donald Trump, but it would be a vessel for some disaffected Republicans to express their disapproval. I think Donald Trump, his support is not as high as he would like it to be to win re-election, although, you know, it's not so far away from where he might need to be. But his support among Republicans is extremely strong. It looks like, you know, most Republican presidents doing well. So 85-90% of Republicans basically like the president. Now, there certainly are some who don't, and the president has picked up some blue-collar voters from the Democratic Party and kind of lost some, you know, Republican suburbanites. That's partly a trend in the Republican Party anyway, and I think, you know, the never Trumpers and those who are very unhappy with Trump within the Republican Party are a little bit more of an elite phenomenon. They're certainly well represented here in Washington, but I don't think that anybody's going to do any damage to him in the primaries. Better to run totally unopposed, but I think the president could run, you know, effectively and win the nomination without too much worry.
Will Marshall, if these investigations don't further undermine Mr. Trump and his ability to run again, how do you see any primary challenges to Mr. Trump?
I'm with John in thinking that they're not very serious. Donald Trump has bonded with the Republican base. In fact, I'd say it's a matter of everlasting shame the way the Republican Party has rolled over for Donald Trump. He's not really a conservative. In fact, in some respects, on trade, for example, he has views that are really at odds with the conservatives. Doesn't seem to care much about fiscal responsibility and other things that conservatives have traditionally cared about. And certainly the libertarian wing, which Bill Weld sort of represents, don't like his interventions in the economy, browbeating of businesses, and his high tariff policies. But he has bonded on a cultural basis, on sort of white identity politics, with the white base of the Republican Party. And so I don't see a serious challenge coming from Republicans who have yet to mount any serious effort to check this president. They rolled over at every turn, and I'm afraid they'll roll over on this declaration of emergency. So the question is, how does he get from strong support of Republicans, which has kept him somewhere around 43-42% popularity in the country, to something close enough to majority so he can get reelected? I don't see how it happens. Suburban women defected in this last election, and so I think it's just a really hard uphill climb for him.
Well, that leads us to the Democrats. In the few minutes we have left, John Forte, a very wide and diverse field. Senators, females, African-Americans, Bernie Sanders threw his hat in. How do you see this field of candidates and who might emerge?
Well, we saw an enormous field on the Republican side in 2016, so much so that we couldn't even have them all in the same debate stage. And I think we'll see that on the Democratic side as well. We're going to have probably upwards of 15 candidates running for president, many of them with serious resumes and important positions. Look, I think the key for Democrats is one candidate who really could attract the African-American vote. And we have two candidates, senators, who are African-American, who might be strong candidates to do that. And then, of course, there will be some who really want to attract the progressive base of the Democratic Party. And I mean that broadly, not just Bernie Sanders progressive, but people who are broadly progressive and really don't like Donald Trump. And there's certainly people out there like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and to some extent Kamala Harris and Kirsten Gillibrand maybe who are appealing to that sort of group as well. Because it's such a big field, it's a little hard to see how those groups could be divided in those ways. But I think the candidate that can do well with one or both of those groups is going to at least have an edge in this large field.
Well, you get the last word. Will Marshall, you're a strong Democrat from the center. Yeah. How do you see this field of a lot of progressives? We see, on the other hand, Amy Klobuchar, who's much more of a centrist Democrat, a senator coming in. And then I'd like to get your take on Mr. Trump, who seems to be falsely characterizing the more liberal wing of the party as socialist and trying to conflate their policies with autocracies like Venezuela. I think that might be something that the Democrats might have to be careful about and perhaps try to push back on.
Well, first of all, it's going to be a fascinating election. I think kind of fun. We usually have on the Democratic side a dominant front runner or two or three dominant figures. This time there isn't anybody dominating the field, and so it's wide open. We're going to have, as John says, we may have 20 candidates before it's all done. And they're going to reflect the diversity of the Democratic Party. Unlike the Republicans, who are pretty monolithic, Democrats are a heterogeneous big tent coalition, philosophically speaking. And so you've already got people bidding for the progressive left. And yes, there is a Democratic socialist wing. They're not dominant. And I guess Bernie Sanders is the closest thing to an honest-to-God socialist in the race. So Trump is not 100% wrong in throwing that word around. But I don't think in the end the Democratic Party is going to nominate a socialist candidate. And here's the reason why. The one thing that unites Will Marshall in the center of the Democratic constellation with Ocasio-Cortez is the overriding desire to spare the country a second Donald Trump term. So Trump is the great divider. His method in politics is divisive and polarizing, but he's the great uniter of Democrats. And so the desire to win, I think, is going to, trump everything else in ideology in this presidential race.
Well, these are early days, and we'll have plenty of time to discuss it at these microphones in the coming weeks and months. On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Fortier, he's director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Will Marshall, president of the Progressive Policy Institute. Gentlemen, thanks so much for a lively and thoughtful conversation.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Cornelius Tanner. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.